From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. This week marks the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Fort Myers, fought during the final months of the Civil War. Fort Myers was the only fort in Peninsular Florida occupied by Union forces. The fort served as a base for Union troops who were raiding cattle and other supplies headed to Confederate troops fighting further north. The fort also served as a refuge from persecution for escaped slaves and Union sympathizers. Today we take a closer look at what actually occurred during the one-day battle, and we step back in time to explore what life was like in Southwest Florida during the years of the Civil War and the state's broader role in the war. We also explore exhibits, lectures, tours, and other local events commemorating this historic anniversary of the southernmost land battle of the Civil War. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live on WGCU. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Today, the downtown Fort Myers River District serves as a hub for peaceful commerce, restaurants, and shopping. But 150 years ago this week, the site served as host to a day-long exchange of rifle and cannon fire in the Battle of Fort Myers, fought February 20th, 1865. Fort Myers served as a base of Union forces who were raiding cattle and other supplies intended for Confederate troops fighting further north. The fort also became a refuge for escaped slaves and Union sympathizers facing persecution from secessionists. The battle pitted Union troops, including a company of black soldiers, against members of the Confederacy's Cattle Guard Battalion, who fought to protect supply lines coming from Florida. Joining me now for a look at what actually occurred during the battle, along with Florida's broader role in the war, and an exploration of what life was like in that time here in Southwest Florida, is Jim Powers. He's a research historian with the Southwest Florida Museum of History, which is currently hosting an exhibit titled Florida in the Civil War, now through April 4th. Jim Powers, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you very much.
And also with us in studio is author, naval historian, lecturer, commentator, and longtime Southwest Florida resident Robert Macomber. His award-winning naval thrillers and his honor series highlight Florida's maritime history and the critical role of the U.S. Navy in America's expansion beginning in the years of the Civil War. The latest book in his honor series is titled The Assassin's Honor, and that will come out this fall. Macomber's lectures on naval and maritime history have taken him throughout the globe. He's also a defense consultant, providing his expertise to a variety of government and military organizations. Robert Macomber, thanks so much for joining us as well.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
And listeners can join our conversation, connect with our guests with your questions and comments as we explore the Battle of Fort Myers and Florida's role in the Civil War. Phone lines are open at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. You can post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media or join the live Twitter chat using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And to start off, I understand there were some corrections right in the recorded billboard at the beginning of the show, and I want you to address those. First of those being that Fort Myers was not the southernmost Union fort or the only one in Peninsular Florida, and that the battle wasn't the southernmost battle in the war.
Well, it's easy to understand how so many people would consider the surrender of the Army of Northern Virginia or the occupation of the capital in Richmond as being the end of the war. We have to realize Florida did not surrender. Tallahassee did not surrender until June of 1865. The belligerency was extremely, extremely violent in what was known as the Trans-Mississippi Department of the Confederacy, which was coincidentally commanded by Kirby Smith, a Floridian. And they were fighting battles there. The Battle of Palmetto Ranch is a good example in May. And so
that was almost
a whole degree, right?
Yeah,
right,
exactly.
Bob? Yeah.
Yeah.
So It's a misnomer, but we are the southernmost land battle east of the Mississippi.
Yes.
Gotcha. Well, let's, I think—
We're east of the Rio Grande.
Actually. Oh, yeah. Actually, that's very good. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about just exactly what was going on there, because I think maybe to folks who aren't too familiar with the area or the area's local history would be surprised to learn that Fort Myers was a Union fort at all.
top?
Yeah, well, the Fort Myers was a very large stockade fort. It was the largest stockade fort in Florida. And it was built during the Seminole Wars. The Seminole Wars ended in 1858, and so it was decommissioned, and there were no troops there from 1858 on, which was only 3 years before the Civil War started. The Union reoccupied the fort in 1864, and they used it for about a little over a year, and they used it to do search and destroy and raids to try to get local Floridians to flock to the Union colors, and also to do the roundup of Confederate cattle, which were feeding Confederate armies further north. They didn't get many people volunteering to join the Union flag. They did find a lot of cattle. They took that cattle in to be used by both the U.S. Army and the U.S. Navy on the coast. And they ranged all over Southwest Florida. It's amazing how far they got. Some of the troops actually marched in May and June of 64 up through the Peace River Valley, which I think is an amazing example of discipline for these troops to march 150 to 200 miles in June in Florida. I invite any of our listeners to try that.
Yeah, put on your wool army suit and see what happens.
Exactly.
In the interest of liability, I do not invite anyone to join. just moving on from there, I would wonder if Union soldiers in general might have just had a more difficult time being here than perhaps Confederate soldiers who were used to Florida's subtropical climate and the flora and fauna here, which is, of course, as we know, nothing like what folks from perhaps New England would be used to.
Climatically. Well, I'm sorry. Yeah,
well, the big problem for the Union troops, and there were white troops from up north here, and there were black troops that were freed slaves from Virginia and from Louisiana that served in this area. And they had the advantage of being what was known back then as being acclimated. Mm-hmm. And they the troops from, let's say, the 110th New York, from Yonkers, New York, were not acclimated. When I say acclimated, I'm not talking about used to the temperatures. I'm talking about having the natural immunization against yellow fever. That was the big killer. And yellow fever in 1862 and 1860 – oops, excuse me, just hit the mic – in 1864 decimated the Union troops and the Union Navy in Florida.
Wow.
It was horrific. Hundreds died.
And you have to think about the political climate that's hand in hand with it. Let us say that I am a Southern cattleman, and I'm very much a part of the Southern heritage. But if I become part of a Southern army fighting, for instance, pitch battles in Virginia, when I return to Southwest Florida, I have no land, no cattle, no family, no livelihood, no money. And while I was gone, were there actually military belligerents that were here causing this effect, or were they just really rustlers?
Yeah, that's really interesting. It makes you wonder why anybody would have wanted to fight for the Confederacy at all. Yet, Florida, as you mentioned before we went live here, actually had more soldiers when you consider the actual population of the state than anybody else.
The 1860 census of Monroe County is very interesting to look at, too. 16 – and of course, we were Monroe County.
Right.
16% slave, of which 95% of that 16% were located in Key West. So there is not a tremendous heritage in terms of slavery present in Monroe County in its northern portions. Today, that would – Henrico, listen to me, native Virginian, in Henry County and in Lee County.
And Collier.
And Collier, yeah. And portions of Collier, yeah. Yeah.
Well, you see the vote to secede. We were the third state to secede, long before some of the more famous ones. Mm. The first was South Carolina in December of 60. The second was Mississippi in early January. And then the third was Florida. And I get that question all the time. Were we in the Civil War? And if we were, what side were we? Oh, my goodness, we were Confederate. Why would we be Confederate? Well, there were 70 plantations in Florida of 1,000 acres or more. And they grew cotton, and they had a longer growing season than much of the other parts of the South. And we also grew sugarcane. And so northern and middle Florida were very much part of the cotton economy of the South.
Okay. So Florida's agroeconomy was dependent on slave labor just as the neighboring southern states.
Now, if people would like to go see a real live Florida antebellum plantation, I want you to get on I-75 and drive up to exit 224, which is by Bradenton. It's right on the north side of the Manatee River, and go to Gamble Plantation. Hmm. It was built in 1844. It had several thousand acres. It had over 200 slaves. It was a sugarcane plantation. And it is a state historical site and in pristine condition. It's very good condition. So you can go there today or tomorrow and get an idea of the economy, the agriculture economy of Florida before the war, and why we voted overwhelmingly to secede in that January convention in Tallahassee.
And remembering that that's where the preponderance of voters were.
Right, exactly.
Kingsley Plantation, there's another good example. Mm-hmm. North to Fernandina, even though I consider the weather up there to be part of South Georgia. As Bob said, I mean, that's where the slaves were. That's where the cash crops were. Together with the cotton was tobacco and rice. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had a very diverse economy based on agriculture, of course. Mm-hmm. And go to middle Florida and then start coming south, there are your big grazing lands. Mm-hmm. So we were cattle, and some more cattle right here.
Yeah.
Well, I had read in preparation for today that some 2,000 soldiers from Florida actually joined Union forces. And I was curious about who those folks had been and what their motivations might have been.
Most of them were from towns in middle Florida, mm-hmm. Tampa, Brooksville, Gainesville. Most of them were tradesmen. One of the leaders was Henry Crane. Henry Crane was the editor of the newspaper in Tampa. Now, Tampa was the big town on the Gulf Coast, Florida, in the our part of Florida, and it had about 200 people in it.
Whoa.
Yeah. And so, yes, there were just under 2,000 that served in northern units. And one of them was right here. The pro-Union Floridians were ostracized by their fellow townspeople and the people in their communities. They were never – I cannot find – and Jim, I don't know if you've ever found any. I can't find any evidence that any of them were ever assaulted or any vandalism or anything like that.
I'm with you.
But they were shunned. And the reason why is because the casualty rates got so bad that if my son is fighting in 900 miles away in northern Virginia in the Florida Brigade, and you refuse to support our state, and you say you're pro-Union, I'm not going to talk to you anymore. I'm not going to buy from your store or from your farm. Mm. I'm not going to sell you anything. I'm not going to hurt you, but I'll ignore you. That's what happened. So these people made a very difficult decision to stay loyal to the United States. They took off leaving their farms, their homes, their businesses, everything they owned. They walked to the Gulf Coast of Florida, most of them, and they waited until they saw a United States warship. No. And they begged to be taken away. And initially they were taken down to Key West, which was a Confederate town under martial law. under occupation. But it was taking too long for the Navy to transport them all that way. They were losing 2 weeks of transport time. So they picked an island on this coast that they knew about from the Seminole Wars. And it was a high island. And it was relatively disease-free. And it's called Yuseppa Island. And you can go there today. It's a private island now, but they have a wonderful museum there. They have a Civil War exhibit, which I put together for them 20-some-odd years ago. And hundreds of them live there. They had to thatch their own huts. They had to live on what they could fish. And for years, they lived there as the war swirled around them on this coast. And then finally, in December of 1863, middle of the war, they petitioned and were given permission to form a pro-Union militia unit. And they did. It was called the Florida Rangers. It was pro-Union. And they went to war on Christmas Eve, 1863. And their mission was to go up to the Myakka River, at the head of the Charlotte Harbor, and to go and search for that major supply source of Confederate Florida, cows. Enemy cows. Can you imagine it?
Yeah. Enemy cows.
And they left on Christmas Eve. Can you imagine the poignancy of that?
Do not think for one second that there was compatibility even among those Union sympathizers or loyalists. Crane is a good example. Bob just mentioned Henry Crane, who ultimately commanded a company of the 2nd Florida Cavalry Union. He was dismissed from the Union service before the Battle of Fort Myers simply because he was preferring charges against other officers. And even the two companies that were stationed here in the 2nd Cavalry, A and B, they were busy preferring charges against one another, involving the generals in Key West. They were very ineffective politically, and yet when it came time to make that long sojourn or that foray into the field and all, the emotions were so high that they overcame all this animosity. So it's a very, very, very complex environment that you find here in the Battle of Fort Myers. There is antipathy. There is you're right, you're wrong. It's complex.
That's actually in history very typical of militia units.
Yeah.
Also, they did not get along well with the black Union troops. The white Floridians culturally weren't used to that kind of thing.
That's probably an understatement when you say,
I'm being kind. I'm being kind, yeah.
In their
letters. And, of course, these guys from New York that were down here, they could barely understand what people were saying if they were a black trooper from – former slave from Louisiana or a white cracker from Florida. – And a lot of these people from the New York regiment were having problems literally understanding what they were saying.
Well, this kind of reminds me of an account from a newspaper correspondent embedded with Union troops in Fort Myers. And he gave a very different account of how race relations went on within the fort than what you're telling me.
What's his name, Brian?
I don't know that he was named in the byline.
I mean Brian Williams. Never mind.
Oh, gotcha. I guess how did that play out when they were in the fort? Did they maintain separate areas or?
Well, yeah, you're housed by your regiment. You know, you're housed by your unit. Mm-hmm. But military discipline overrides all that. But personal animosities were very real. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And members of the Cow Cavalry, I mean, are these folks that you would even really consider troops, or were these more?
Oh yeah,
they were mustered. They were mustered into the Confederate forces.
They were very much troops.
Yeah.
And the reason we're named after Robert E. Lee, this county, of Lee County, is because of our first sitting board of commissioners. Three out of the five men there were in the Florida Cavalry.
Mm.
They served, and they were extremely proud of the fact that they were in the Confederate Army. They were under fire. There were skirmishes. There were there was a lot of action with those guys, yeah.
F.A. Henry's a good example.
Exactly. Yes.
He commanded one of the companies in this particular conflict, and was extremely proud. In fact, he claimed to have made the nomination to the legislature, this be Lee County.
Oh. And his home is still standing and over in LaBelle.
Mm-hmm.
Which I understand is actually named for his daughters.
LaBelle. Yeah. That is correct.
Mm-hmm. Well, and let's talk about what actually occurred on the day of the battle. From what I understand, part of the reason that they wanted to attack the fort when they did was because they'd gotten word that the Union was looking to abandon the fort soon anyway.
You've got to go way back to set the scene for
this. Let's go back further then. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you have to understand that the Union – its perspective and the South, its perspective on everything that we're going to talk about from here on is totally different. And you're going to have to also acknowledge that no two historians tell the same tale. I'm among those. I mean, we all have an agenda and somewhat jaundiced perspective depending on what we've discovered and how we interpret it. So it's been raining. It's been flooding. The river is running high and swift. It's nasty. Confederate troops start in Tampa. They then go to Fort Meade. Then they go to Fort Thompson. Then they travel along the southern bank of the Caloosahatchee. During this entire time, they're facing all sorts of difficulties.
Just to interrupt for a moment for our listeners. Fort Thompson is now called LaBelle.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
There was that's good, Bob.
There was a cattle ford across the river there.
And when they crossed, they lost a lot of their commissary and they lost a lot of their ordnance so that their ammunition was wet, what they had left. They were carrying one field piece. You're following cattle trails that are mud bogs. It's an extremely difficult environment, so you start there knowing how tough it is just getting here.
And the cattle trail they were following is now called Palm Beach Boulevard.
Wow.
Some would say still a cattle trail.
Yeah. Well, so bring us up to, you know, the time that the battle actually occurred here. And
They arrived on the evening of the 19th of February, crossed the river. They're now proceeding toward the fort along the cattle trail. The commander of the militia unit, but they've been mustered by this time. The commander of the Cow Cavalry decides that he's going to send a raiding party to capture the pickets. Now, the pickets are in the vicinity of what is today Billy's Creek. Billy's Creek, of course, Billy Bowlegs from the 1858 evacuation.
And that was at where WINK is.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right next to the bridge. Mm-hmm. And it was such bad weather that these approximate 10 raiders passed the pickets twice and were never discovered. Neither saw the other. That's how bad the weather was. So when the morning of the 20th came, then the decision was made to send another foray, and these raiders came out about another 10 or 12, and they then captured the pickets. So, Bob?
And not without a fight.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, they were trying to capture them without a fight so the fort would not be alerted. Mm-hmm. You know, quietly, they were going to capture. Didn't work out that way. These troops opened fire, and they were black troops that were – some of them were trying to get some washing done.
Mm-hmm.
And they spotted the Confederates. There was a short, sharp fight. The Confederates captured the outpost. And if I remember correctly, two men were wounded. One was killed.
One black sergeant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the problem for the Confederates is, at that point, the main force inside the fort is alerted. So there is no element of surprise anymore for the Confederates. And as Jim was explaining, the weather was terrible. It's February, which means we can surmise that there was a cold front coming through. This means the wind would have been out of the southwest, very strong, and bringing thunderstorms like the ones we got last night.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's about the same time period of the year. And so the fields were flooded. The battlefield was flooded. Ammunition is no longer dry, and they've got lots of trouble.
And you must think, too, that the fort is not the fort of 1850. It is not the fort of 1858. Mm-hmm. It's the fort of 1864. There is no longer a stockade. There are now four blockhouses, and they have adopted the strategic point of defense. In other words, they defend the blockhouses and nothing else. They're berm set up. Some counts are 12 feet. Some accounts are less. But you can't shoot over them. And so everyone has to, in skirmish lines and artillery duels, they have to come outside of these berms, stand in the open, and engage one another.
Mm. And the fighting then went on for just a day?
Half a day.
Yeah. Half a day.
The Union commander's after action report says at 1:10 the cannon fire opened. Previous to that, I think it's important to know Footman, who is commanding. He's the executive officer of the Cal Cavalry. He sends a "you better surrender" message under a white flag. And it, for lack of specificity, the Union commander, Captain Doyle, says, we'll surrender when you make us. And they withdrew. And the Union report says that they exchanged cannon fire at 1,400 yards. Once again, at 5 degrees elevation, a 12-pound Napoleon is going to just about fall out of the sky straight down and hit the ground with no momentum left at 1,400 yards. Mm. And a musket is good for 100. A rifle musket is good for 200 to 300. So interesting accounts as to how they shot at one another.
Yeah, I think the ranges were much closer.
Absolutely. Had to be. They had to be.
1,400 yards?
Yeah.
Is a very long way.
Yeah.
2,000 yards is a mile. Yeah. It's a nautical mile. So 1,400 yards is almost a mile.
Now think about how much field of fire has to be cleared.
Exactly, yeah.
I've never seen a direct fire weapon that can go around trees.
They got their range off on the
Way off. So they were eyeballing one another. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing is, as we have previously discussed, with everything wet and with low quantities, they probably, and according to the Union, they probably only exchanged around 20 rounds of cannon fire all afternoon long and then withdrew.
Hmm. Well,
Gettysburg it was not.
Yes. Yeah. No. We were talking a little bit about Gettysburg before the show.
And I get people that say, oh, well, that's not a big thing. No, it's a real big thing if you're the one getting shot at.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a real big thing.
Yeah.
But this was the biggest event in our area. So that's why it's remembered.
And to help folks maybe understand a little bit about exactly where this occurred, Jim, can you tell us where the fort existed as compared to what might be there now in downtown?
Yeah, I sure can. One of my pet research projects has been for the last 3.5 years is the fort itself and its footprint. And there's just so much misinformation that's out there. It roughly, if you think about downtown Fort Myers today, the first thing you need to think about is if you're standing on Bay Street or Edward Street, you're going to drown, because half of Fort Myers downtown historic district is recovered from the Caloosahatchee River beginning in 1908. And so that riverfront, as we think of it, just think of just north of First Street, just barely north of First Street, as being the eastern northernmost side of the river, because though we talk in terms of cardinal directions, north, south, east, west, the river certainly doesn't run in a cardinal direction. The fort was certainly not cardinally oriented. So when you read an account and they say, and we swung around to the south and shot at them and so forth, well, I'm not really sure where the south is. But there, if you look at the fort, it probably – in fact, GIS is now working on a – and thank you very much in GIS – working on a superimposition over a contemporary map today that is in fact accurate. It's going to be the Eastern Stockade Wall in 1856, where there is a survey at the National Archives done in surveyor's links, which is 0.66 feet, is going to be somewhere just west of Fowler, maybe even as far as Royal Palm. It's going to be Broadway. And it's going to be somewhere just beyond Main Street before you get to Second. Mm-hmm. And you have to remember that there's Camp Daniels. Camp Daniels is created in 55, Bob, I believe, to relieve forces that are upriver during the mosquito season, during our monsoonal attack. And they come down here. Well, that's just as big as the fort itself. And so the two structures. But it was certainly large. As Bob said, it's the largest stockaded fort in 1856 in all of Florida. But by 1864, it's another world. It's a totally different environment in terms of fort design and so forth.
Yeah, it had been abandoned, you know. And right. And so
was it used as anything in that interim between the Seminole Wars?
No. There were some squatters, but
yeah, just
but, and people and some of the squatters took things apart from, you know, if they needed lumber or something. There are homes in Fort Myers today that have lumber from that fort.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
Oh.
Not many, but some.
And once again, we're into what you can prove and what you can't prove. But if you think of the end of the American Civil War and the abandonment of Fort Myers, as I tell folks that come through the museum, it became the largest Home Depot and Lowe's in the world, and it was pro bono.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so people came from Fort Brooke, Tampa, from Key West, literally the fort was raided. In 1966, you have the Gonzalez extended family that comes here to be original settlers of the settlement of Fort Myers. They move into the commanding officer's house, and everyone uses the supplies of this giant warehouse of an institution.
Yeah. Okay. So nobody was thinking about – nobody thinks about themselves as being in history. They weren't worried about preserving a fort. They continued to use it.
Well, they needed – you know, especially after the war.
Yeah.
This was a devastated state, all the South was. And the Army wasn't using it, so, you know, I'm going to borrow the stuff and build my own house.
Right, right. Well, listeners can join our conversation as well. You can connect with our guests with your phone calls, questions, and comments as we explore the Battle of Fort Myers and Florida's larger role in the Civil War. We're talking with Robert Mayhomer and Jim Powers today. Phone lines are open at 877-GCU-TALK. That's 1-877-428-8255. You can send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or join the live Twitter chat using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And, you know, just looking at what occurred in the Battle of Fort Myers here, a one-day battle, casualties relatively low. Mm-hmm. It came late in the war. was the battle itself terribly significant in the larger context of the Civil War?
Well, the battle, I don't think was, but the campaign, the Union campaign in this area was. It did disrupt that Confederate supply line of cattle, mm-hmm. And carried the war to the enemy. Now, the Navy had been trying to do this and with a certain amount of success all during the war. And in 1863, the Navy finally expanded and brought in smaller vessels that could penetrate into the shallow waters, not just sail offshore, but go into the bays and the rivers. And they started knocking out the blockade running on this coast, which had been extensive.
I wanted to talk with you more in detail about mm-hmm. blockade running.
Yeah.
It just seems like incredibly dangerous work trying to, you know, move under the cover of night.
Well, but the fortunes that were made were incredible, just incredible. People ask me, what in the world do we have down here that anybody would want to buy, especially back then? And the things that we ran out through the blockade were cotton from Middle Florida and Upper Florida, and also turpentine.
Turpentine.
We have a lot of pine trees. And turpentine was used in everything from industrial, commercial uses to medicine.
And what were we bringing in? Rum?
And, well, actually, you're right. We would run this cotton out. Let me explain the fortunes that were made.
Yes.
At the beginning of the war, there's two kinds of cotton. There's long staple and short staple. There's highland cotton and lowland cotton. We grew lowland cotton in Florida. Well, it went for about $1 a pound. A bale was about 100 pounds. They didn't have big bale presses like they do now, because a bale now is much, much heavier than that. The average blockade runner on this coast was carrying between 10 and 15 to 20 bales. Okay? So let's just say it's 10, and it's a small vessel running the blockade. That's 1,000 pounds. Okay? That's $1 a pound, beginning of the war. Where are they running the blockade to? They're running to Spanish Cuba, British Bahamas, or French Mexico. And people forget that in 1862, the French occupied Mexico in about as big a violation of the Monroe Doctrine mm-hmm. as you can imagine.
Like Napoleon III cared.
Exactly. So that's where they would run the blockade to. So you got $1,000 for that one run in 1862 on a four-day, five-day sail to Havana. Now, in 1863, it's going for $4 a pound.
Mm.
You're now making $4,000. The average wage of a skilled worker in the 1860s, the average annual pay was about $300 to $400.
Oh, wow. So they are amassing fortunes here.
They're amassing fortunes they can do in 1 week. Now, that's just on the run out. On the run in, you asked, what did they carry? Well, I've looked at the cargo manifests for the ones that were captured. And about a third, a little more than a third of the cargo manifests list Cuban rum or French brandy. And then following that, there were canned goods. That's when we first started getting canned goods in the world. And then there were household items. For instance, I always ask my audiences when I give the talk, how much would you pay for real milled French soap if you haven't had any soap in 2 years?
Yeah.
Right. So they were making money going out the blockade and making money coming in the blockade. And there were some legendary blockade runners in this coast. Robert Johnson's one of my favorites. He got captured 3 times. The first time, he explained to the U.S. Navy that this was a mistake and he didn't have the right paperwork. He thought he had the right paperwork. And gosh, he's very sorry and he'll never do that again. And on the second time, he got his parole papers, and in order to get them to be let go on parole, he had to promise he would never, ever do this again. And the third time he got captured by the U.S. Navy, they didn't listen to his explanations anymore, and he was taken to Fort Taylor in Key West. And two of his ships are on the bottom at Punarassa. They're completely destroyed. Mm. Please do not dive at Punarassa.
Okay.
You'll get run over by the boat traffic, and the current's terrible. But Robert Johnson is very typical of the blockade runners. A legendary one out of Tampa was named McKay. And there, his family, all these families are still here. And then there was the famous Frenchman, Monsieur Tresca. And Tresca was a Frenchman who moved to Florida before the war and very successfully ran the blockade and was part of the very end of the war here, which was a very intriguing end. The Confederate National Government came to Florida to escape. Mm. So, yeah, Tresca was part of their escape route.
Yeah. Well, let me ask, because, you know, as you've articulated these blockade runners, you know, weren't all just Southerners. You had French, British, Spanish. Was there any potential there for, like, international incidents?
All the time. The official records of the blockading squadron that worked this peninsula of Florida are almost 1,000 pages long.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There were all kinds of international incidents. I just don't have time to cover them today.
Sure,
but
sure.
I find it amazing that the admiral of the U.S. Navy in Key West was constantly explaining to his counterparts in the Spanish Navy in Cuba and the British Navy in the Bahamas that the U.S. Navy would never, ever, ever violate their territorial waters like they were complaining that the U.S. Navy did.
Yeah.
Because the Navy actually did violate their waters. And there are three U.S. Navy shipwrecks in the Bahamas from the Civil War.
Wow.
And one of them actually hit the island. It's a little hard to deny you're there when one of your largest cruisers hits the island and sinks right in front of the beach.
Well,
in the Abacos.
I mean, now, you know, 150 years later, is there much to be seen for divers now?
Well, there's a legacy. There's a legacy in the Abacos, and many sailors from Florida go to the Abacos, which are the northern string of islands in the Bahamas, and they have a very well photographed, famous lighthouse there at Hopetown. That lighthouse was built in 1864 by the British government to help the blockade runners.
Oh, wow!
Yeah, because they were using man o' war. Key and the Abacos to run the blockade.
Well, we do have to take a short break right now, but when we return, our conversation will continue with Robert Makomer, acclaimed author and naval historian, along with Jim Powers with the Southwest Florida Museum of History. So we'll be right back with that conversation. Stay with us. You're listening to WGCU NPR for Southwest Florida. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for being with us. If you're just tuning in, February 20th will mark the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Fort Myers and the Civil War. Our discussion today is taking us back in time for a look at what life was like on our region back then in the 1860s. We've been discussing what actually occurred during the battle, and we've been moving more into looking at sort of the naval aspects of what was going on around Florida during the Civil War. Robert Makomer is with us, acclaimed author and a naval historian. We also have Jim Powers, historian with the Southwest Florida Museum of History. And listeners can join our conversation as well. You can connect with our guest with a phone call to 877-GCU-TALK. That's 1-877-428-8255. Or join the live Twitter chat using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. And Bob, I wanted to get back into the conversation now. We were going to take a look at some of the shipwrecks from that time that are
seven shipwrecks on this coast from the Civil War. Six of them are blockade runners. I want to first issue a warning to everyone. Please do not try to dive on these shipwrecks. First off, they're buried under sand. You can't find them without professional equipment. Secondly, the currents here can be extremely dangerous. And thirdly, in several areas, they are in areas of heavy boat traffic. Hmm. So if the current doesn't get you and you don't get stuck in the sand on the bottom, you'll probably get run over by a boat. So please don't try this. But two of them are on the Peace River. Two are at Punarasa. Two, interesting enough, which flew the Spanish flag of Cuba, are off the beach at Sanibel Island. And one of them is a United States warship at Cape Romano Shoals, south of Marco Island. And a lot of people, when I give talks at Marco, they go, well, you know, we understand that, you know, there was something going on at Fort Myers, but we weren't part of this at all, were you? Most definitely. The blockade runners used the bays around Marco Island to hide from the U.S. Navy ships blockading the coast. And the smallest vessel of the U.S. Navy squadron was called the Rosalie. And she was a former blockade runner, which was brought into the U.S. Navy. She was captured off South Carolina. She was 45 feet long. And she was brought into the U.S. Navy, commissioned, armed, given a Navy crew, and sent to our coast to penetrate in the bays and the rivers and those places that the Confederates thought were safe. And she did this starting in the summer. Mm. Okay, no bug screens, no bug spray in the summer.
Control district, right?
No bimini top for the boat, you know. And she did, starting in the summer of 63, she ended up penetrating and was involved in these inshore waters with both joint Army-Navy operations and with Navy operations. And went after blockade runners left and right. One of them, her last capture, was at Marco Island in 1864, where she – now, this was a sailing gunboat. She had no engine. She outsailed a steamer running the blockade.
How is that even possible?
Well, through brilliant seamanship.
Okay.
And very determined sailors – and she captured that steamer at Marco Island. Her first capture was in the Caloosahatchee River in July of 1863. And the Confederates saw her coming and took up the channel markers, which was very not – that was not cricket, was it?
No. And not very sportsmanlike.
Not very sportsmanlike. And so the Navy had to find out where the sandbars were. Much the same way that many of our local residents do now, by hitting them. Mm. And they finally captured a ship that they had heard had a load of cotton and some slaves on it. And by the time they got up the river to where that schooner was, the cotton and the slaves had been removed from the ship. That was a British schooner from the Bahamas. And that place that they captured that ship is now called Cape Coral.
Ah.
And it was at Harney Point.
You know, I know you do these, you know, historical, you know, boat tours around
yeah,
the area.
Yeah, they've turned out to be very popular.
I would imagine that there's really an element of that that really kind of feels like you're stepping back in time.
That's what I want them to do.
Yeah. I mean, and by that, I mean, does it yes. feel that way because you're looking at a lot of barrier islands that perhaps might look much like they did 150 years ago as opposed to, say, Cape Coral?
That's exactly what I tell them. I don't remember seeing you on one of these cruises.
I haven't yet.
But you
yet.
Should come. We go to areas where there are not 1.5 million people in sight, mm-hmm. like in the urban areas here, and where the things that you're seeing are the same things that the U.S. Navy and the Confederate blockade runners saw, the same scenery. And so you are transported back in time. And I tell them the story of these brave people on both sides, and I don't take sides on this. I always get that question, well, since you're from here, aren't you a pro-Confederate? You know what? There was enough bravery and treachery on both sides to last a lifetime. So, no, I do honor and respect to both sides. These were very truly brave people. And so I take people back. I want them to no longer think it's 2015. It's now 1863.
Yeah. Well, let's earlier in the program you had talked about, you know, union sympathizers living on Yuseppa Island.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I imagine that at least a couple of those folks are going to be a subject of the talk you're going to be giving on February 26th.
Yes, very good. Southwest nice Florida. Segue. Yeah. I like that. Very good. Yes.
And I know that one's sold out, but there is another one on Thursday, March 19th, I believe, as well. That one still has seats available.
Yes.
Again, I don't want to ruin anything for folks who have tickets to that, but is there much you can tell us now about the couple?
Well, this is one of my favorite talks because it's very I'll tell you, it's very, very emotional for me. Because this story reached out and grabbed a hold of my life 20 years ago, 130 years after the war ended, in a very unusual way. So when I'm telling this story, it is a love story. It's a war story. It's the story of an incredible woman who persevered and ended up becoming the mother of some of the founding families of this coast. Her descendants are all over this coast. And the story starts out in 1995 and at a cocktail party in Tallahassee, Florida. So I hope people can come and hear this story. You will feel good when this story is over. You will laugh during this story. You may feel some tears, but you will be amazed because this story is the story of this country, of this state of Florida, and of this coast. Wow. So it's how's that for a
– That is a great teaser right
yeah.
there.
And John, I'll tell you, so I can further plug, if your listeners really enjoy Bob, on the 19th, we had a second lecture because the first one sold out and it sold out so quickly. So if you want to hear Bob on March 19th, call the museum. Call them soon so that we can get you on a list. We had 100 within a couple of days.
Yeah, these things kind of fill up. My cruises fill up pretty quickly too. We started out just doing two. They filled up within 3 days. Then we did four. Then we did six. Now we're doing eight because they keep filling up. So we keep adding. The Civil War tours, if you call Captiva cruises.
Okay.
Then they're adding on some more in March.
Oh, yes.
I'm going to have a busy March.
Yeah, looks like it. Well, I that is all the time we have for today's show. We're coming up on the end of the hour already. But thank you so much to my guests, Jim Powers and Robert Maycomber.
It's been great to be with you.
We really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jim Powers is a research historian for the Southwest Florida Museum of History in downtown Fort Myers. The museum is currently hosting an exhibit titled Florida in the Civil War, now through April 4th. And Bob Maycomber, acclaimed author, naval historian, lecturer, and commentator. His latest installment in his naval thriller honor series titled The Assassin's Honor comes out this fall. He'll also provide a special lecture presentation titled The Patriot and the Widow. That's going to be at the Southwest Florida Museum of History February 26th. That one is sold out, but there is going to be an encore with space still available the evening of Thursday, March 19th. And also, as you can find out more about his historic boat tours around the region at CaptivaCruises.com. There's more information on today's show and past editions of the program online at WGCU.org/Gulf Coast Live. Continue the conversation on Facebook at WGCU Public Media and on Twitter using hashtag Gulf Coast Live. Thanks to my producers Richard Chinqui and Luke Martin. This is WGCU Fort Myers 90.1 FM, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.